Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done for, think now, 36 years, starting in September of 1982. Main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who teach each other how wireless equipment works. We don't have 100% accuracy, as was recently brought to our attention. I had a great big pronouncement a few weeks ago about pattern of a loop antenna that's parallel to the ground, the fact that it is a Nevis antenna. It is not. I had to correct that. Thought about it the next week. All real engineers realize they don't have a 1,000 batting average. Nobody bats 1,000. There's a certain error rate, no matter how hard you try. And I'm a realistic engineer, and I've watched engineers for 45 years of my experience. Some of them will laugh at themselves when they make a mistake and learn from it and proceed forward and correct it. Others will use all kinds of weasel wording, saying, no, I didn't say that, and I didn't make a mistake. They believe because of their education they couldn't possibly make a mistake. That, of course, is impossible. Let me drop them. So you got to be a little bit careful with the material that we present to you. Sometimes it's got some built-in errors to check how good you are at finding errors, if you know what I mean. Okay, the net is broken up into roughly three sections. Depending on the amount of enthusiasm, the sections get expanded or contracted. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment to the net. They give us, for the net, they give us their call letters and their name after waiting for the three beeps or four beeps to make sure the machine gets properly reset so that they don't time out. That's followed by Roy AC2GS with his science talk, and he's got quite an interesting list tonight, and that's going to be then followed by Paul WS2N with the space report. And I guarantee tonight you're going to be hearing about the new spacecraft that's going to Mars. It will be impacting Mars' atmosphere tomorrow at roughly 3 o'clock local time, the InSight spacecraft, which is going to be making a kind of measurements that have never been made before on Mars. Guarantee Paul will be telling you a lot about that. On page 10 of Sunday's Newsday, let me drop a foot. Today's Newsday has a full page on the subject of InSight. Two very nice pictures, a whole lot of words explaining quite a bit about it, why it's significant. Of all the things that have been sent to Mars, only 40% of them were successful at landing on the surface of Mars. The other 60% all failed in one way or another. Of the 40% of those that did succeed, they were all American involvement spacecraft. So many nations have tried, and most of them never got something to get onto the surface of Mars. Very difficult target. As you approach Mars, the local gravity well causes you to speed up, and you're going to be going something like 12,500 miles an hour. Earth has a much deeper gravity well when something approaches Earth from a long distance, like an astronaut returning from the moon. The speed you get at the surface of the Earth, you encounter the atmosphere at 25,000 miles an hour. So in the case of hitting Mars at 12,500 miles an hour and having an atmosphere that's 1% as dense as the Earth, you don't get anywhere near as much aerobraking with your heat shield and so on. Makes it a very difficult maneuver to get there safely. Okay, you'll be hearing a lot more about that from Paul when we get there. Let me drop. For those who do have a question or a comment, they're going to tell me right now your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in to say you're listening. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. So, those who do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters right now. Oh, wait a minute. We got a holdover from last week. We didn't get to get to Joe to the A2RYY. So I'm going to put him on the top of the list. He's a holdover from last week. So, Joe, you almost don't have to sign in to the A2RYY. Anyone else who's got a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RIW listening.
B2HMM, Charlie. No comment, just how is everybody in the net?
Good morning, Charlie. Good afternoon. Okay. Anyone else who signed in who does have a question or comment, please give me a call letters and name right now.
WB2JOB. Bob, yes.
Okay, we've got you, Bob. WB2JOB. Anyone else to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
Is your radio making all that racket?
You're saying my radio making all that? I think you're meaning the hissing sound. Is that what you're talking about, sir? That racket there? Eric, go ahead.
I'm listening to you directly. I'm sure a lot of noise in the background. Also, the audio quality doesn't sound like your usual self.
Okay, I'm going to listen to my input. I'm listening to my input, and it sounds normal to me, a little bit lower than what comes out of the output of the machine. So, any chance that there is a slight distortion happening in whatever you're using as a receiver because it's alongside of a transmitter, Eric?
No, that might be a very interesting question. I've got multiple receivers going on coming out of the same speaker, and I may be adding and subtracting. Let me see now. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen that happen where multiple receivers coming out of the same speaker, like you said, adding and subtracting, and they've all got slightly different time delay of their IF strips and so on. So certain notes get sucked out and certain notes don't get sucked out. So as you turned off some of those receivers, did my audio improve a little bit? Over to you, Eric.
Now you sound like yourself, so there was probably some phasing stuff going on. Anyway, sorry about that. Carry on.
Okay, one more call. Anyone who does have who has a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we'll start off with Joe. I hope Joe's on frequency. He's a holdover from last week. Joe, WA2 Romeo Yankee Yankee, K2LIZ. Give it ahead, Joe.
Oh, look at that. I'm making the system. Isn't that great? Well, actually, it's not a question. It's a comment from a subject you talked about 2 weeks ago, okay? And the subject was on duplexes, and my comment with that subject is I don't agree with everything that was being said about the tune-up, or I say the adjustment procedures on duplexes. I maybe have a little different way of doing things, but whatever. That's all it was, just a comment.
Give us a couple of words, Joe, as to how you tune up a duplexer. It does require some interesting manipulations because a real good duplexer might have an amount of isolation between the transmitter port and the receiver port of 100, 110, 120 dB, and very few pieces of instrumentation will directly display that number of decibels of isolation without resetting some of the knobs during the measurement, which, in other words, very few things have more than 100 dB of display on the screen, so to speak. So there's probably a couple of tricks that you've learned as to how to get around that. To be 12YY, on the tune-up of a duplexer, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I do own an instrument that is capable of looking at not in one shot dynamically, but it can measure the actual isolation of a duplexer going down, actually past 120 decibels differential from input to output. The path adjustment affects the notching very, very much. So once you adjust the path for the best combination of low loss on your desired passing frequency and the best return loss, which sometimes is not easy to do if you don't have a vector network analyzer, but in a combination of using a service monitor in a couple of different setup ways of looking at the pass-through adjustment and then a slight tweaking of the pass cans to get the best return loss, looking into one, two, or three pass cans, depending on what you want to do, then you would adjust the notching. You can either adjust the notching one at a time per can, and that usually works out pretty good, but there's a little bit of interaction. I found that when you adjust the notching on each can, then you put all three cans together with the cabling, you look at the total result. Sometimes it shifts a little bit. So you do need to have an instrument capable of looking at the total isolation from one end to the other. There goes my TOT. And also, it's also a very good idea to use very, very good cabling. I happen to use quarter-inch Superflex with the appropriate attenuator pads on each cable to take that to minimize the VSWR effect of the cables into my, for my test instruments coming and going to the duplexer at hand, that's being what you'd call a device under test.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm listening on another frequency. I don't know if I don't know if I timed that or it held or whatever. What happened?
All's well. Don't worry. Please proceed.
Okay. The instrument I use when I want to, you know, really do a precision job on a duplexer, especially a pass notch duplexer on a different band, high band, 220 or UHF. I bought it many years ago, and with a combination of an add-on preamp and also the option of the analyzer itself, which happens to have a very, very narrow bandwidth settable range on the duplexer. It can go down to 200 hertz bandwidth, resolution bandwidth, which is pretty unique because most service monitors don't even approach something like that. So it lets you actually, in reality, look at the noise floor, go down quite deeply into the noise and actually, you know, see something down there. I tested the analyzer already with a combination of precision pads using my service monitor, and when it's set up properly, using my test cabling, I can actually see down to about minus 135 on the analyzer by itself. The analyzer by itself puts at about minus 10 out of the tracking generator port if I'm using that as a tune-up device by itself. I've tried doing it with my service monitor. The service monitor is a little harder because it doesn't have the dynamic range, number one, and number two, the noise floor is not that good on the service monitor. It's typically about minus 100, so I have to use an add-on. Sure wish that the timer was set to 3 minutes instead of 90 seconds. It would make things a hell of a lot easier on the TechNet, you know? The service monitor doesn't have the adaptability very easily, even with the add-on preamp, which gives me about 20 dB added to the normal plus like 0 dBm or so on the output of the generator, so I can go up to the highest point about plus 20 on the service monitor. But I don't have the dynamic range because I can't look down into the noise with that. It has no way of putting a preamp on the input. So my HP analyzer is a little better. Be looking at the total dynamic range of the duplexer, not in one shot, but by setting your reference levels, I can look at what my pass loss is through one can, two can, or three cans. Setting it up with the tracking generator and using a directional coupler, I can look at the return loss of all three cans usually together, just to see how if they're optimized. Then I can look at the actual transfer to receiver isolation on both respective frequencies. Over to you, Dick. That was it.
When the duplexer is being used under normal circumstances, the transmitter is on a frequency 600 kc lower than where the receiver is set. On this repeater, for instance, 146.25 and 146.85. Is it? So, yeah. To 600 kc apart. So, there are two kinds of signal that can pour through the duplexer that get into the receiver. One is noise sidebands of the transmitter, 600 kc above and below the transmitter. Those noise sidebands can come through on the receiver frequency, into the receiver. Second of all, the transmitter frequency, which is 600 kc away from the receiver, that signal can come leaking through and possibly be strong enough to overload the front end of the receiver. So when you're looking at isolation, are you putting in a weak signal into the transmitter port of the duplexer on the receiver frequency? In other words, if you put in a frequency 600 kc higher than the normal transmitter frequency for looking at receiver duplexer isolation is one way of doing it, because that way of doing it, you've got a clear, coherent sine wave signal that represents a simple vertical spike on the spectrum analyzer. And when that's set at, in your case, 200 hertz of resolution bandwidth, you have the greatest sensitivity of looking at that spike as opposed to looking at noise. So what frequency do you plug in to the transmitter port when you're measuring transmitter to receiver isolation? Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Well, looking at you know, the isolation actually on the there's a couple of different ways of doing it. The you can do it two different ways. I've tested it with, and it gives you a little bit of variation as far as what your end result is. You can actually put a 50 ohm load on the antenna port and put a receive signal in on the transmitter side and look at what you get on the receiver port, and vice versa, just switch frequencies. And that'll tell you, the isolation actually port to port of what you have going through the whole thing. It doesn't vary very much going through the, if you look at the antenna port, maybe a little bit slightly. There's a slight bit of a difference I've noticed in many cases. It may change a little bit. Now, of course, with the impedance of the power amplifier and the impedance of the receiver input, these can apparently change what your power notch depth looks like on a specific frequency, because they're being tuned into a 50 ohm impedance. And of course, your impedance, if it's not 50 ohms, it's gonna change a little bit. I have not ever really tried to tweak that to try to optimize it, because I find it doesn't really make a lot of difference. You sort of get what you get if you tune it up by the math. You sort of tune it up by the manufacturer's specifications, and they many of them will tell you to use a pair of at least 6 dB CADs on very good quality cables on each CAD at a time, and to adjust your pass first and then adjust your notch, because a slight movement of your pass, or even moving the stem or putting pressure on it, you can watch your...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So, thusly, if you try to optimize the duplexer by squeezing an extra tenth of a dB by turning your pass adjustments on the transmitter leg, you might get another tenth of a dB out of the duplexer, but should also knock your notch adjustments way, way, way out of whack.
I can see at least two different ways of tuning for best isolation when it's connected to good 50 ohm instrumentation, which is the first step. You can put the real transmit frequency through and tune the spectrum analyzer connected to the receiver port to the transmitter frequency to find out how much is coming through. That's one approach. Or to put a signal into the transmitter port that is on the receiver frequency and find out how much comes through. So the spectrum analyzer and the receiver port could be set either to the receiver frequency or the transmitter frequency for different portions of that test. And my guess is you get slightly different isolations when you do that test. Is that true, Eric? Joe?
Well, here's another note, which I didn't say, and some manufacturers will even tell you this right outright, or if you call their engineering department, they'll tell you likewise. They don't recommend that you adjust the pass cavities at all by applying transmitter power into the pass cavities, because you can cause arcing on the contacts within the stem of the duplexer on the pass side. It can cause you a problem, and I've heard of that happening before. So they recommend you use test equipment to tune it up with, and then go from there. But some people try to do it with the transmitter key. That's why you get the extra tenth of a dB out of the thing. It's not recommended by doing something like that. Really, it doesn't buy you really anything in the real world as far as the differential of what you had compared to what the manufacturer tells you to tune it up. Is that what you wanted to hear, Dick?
That's also a very good piece of information. I was assuming that all frequencies going into the into the duplexer were coming from instrumentation, but I see a problem. Your signal generator rarely has anywhere near as much power as the real transmitter. Therefore, to look down as far as you'd like to look down to see the real isolation becomes a little bit more difficult. And you did, on the second subject, you did talk about the fact that the real transmitter is not 50 ohms in its output impedance. The real receiver is not 50 ohms on its input impedance. The real antenna is not 50 ohms exactly on its impedance on either of the two frequencies. So therefore, from the tune-up of best isolation and matching when connected to laboratory test equipment versus the real things, a little bit of shifting takes place. And to try to readjust for the in-situ situation, in other words, in the real environment to do a final touch-up, I can see how that that takes a lot of art and science, doesn't it, Joe? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay. Well, I'll give an example of a real meat potatoes type of answer, what you're sort of looking for here. After I tuned up my initially tuned up the duplexer I'm using on my USF repeater, which is actually a four cavity what do they call that thing? 1533, something like that. 1533. It's Motorola duplexer. They give you a lot of isolation port to port, but they're extremely touchy as far as trying to tune them up. The pass adjustments are, they will move the notches like crazy. And getting the notch set by itself is also quite a trick to get it done. But once you succeed in doing such, I'm running a receiver up there. It's a UHS receiver. And the receiver by itself is typically about 0.25 for 20 dB of quality, somewhere around that figure. I run an A squared up preamp ahead of the receiver, and I run a PD941 pass cavity ahead of the preamp as it comes out of the receiver port of the duplexer. So, because the receiver port of the duplexer it notches down the transmit frequency tremendously at 5 megs away, but when you look at the rest of the world coming through that receiver port, it really doesn't do that. Like I said, I wish the TOT was longer in the repeater. But when you look at the real world coming through the receiver port of any duplexer, besides your transfer frequency, it's not down that far at all. And you really, in a lot of cases, if you expect to run a preamp on the receiver, transmitter noise at your site is going to be one thing you're going to have to deal with, but something else is going to be out-of-band, high-level emissions out-of-band. That could be not only high-level energy within your band, in the UHF band, it could be high-level stuff on VHF, for example, if you're playing with a UHF repeater. Something way, way far away can put out enough energy coming down your antenna, down through your receiver port. You may find a receiver port, maybe it's only 50 or 60 decibels, maybe a little more than that, out of band. And sometimes this causes you grief, so running a an extra cavity on the receiver helps. But the point I was trying to get at, when I checked the repeater when I put it into service many years ago, I check it frequently from time to time when I go up to service it, I'm ringing a 10 dB station master on the thing. I've taken the receiver, RF cap I have, which is set to about 50 dB of isolation, between the center pin and the feed-through, and I can put that, I believe I talked for 90 seconds, you know, really don't, it's hard to believe. And I've checked the sensitivity, and after I calculate, find out what my online sensitivity of the receiver by itself is without the transmitter running, I'll key the transmitter. And I'll only see about a change of about maybe 2 dB worse with the transmitter coming up, which is really not terribly bad at all, considering I'm running a preamp on the thing. Back to you.
You turn on the transmitter and you see a 2 dB difference. You're not talking about descents now, is that true, Paul? No joke.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. When you hook the repeater to the receiver antenna, it's a repeater antenna, the sensitivity of the receiver is not the same as it is into a signal generator. You realize that, and I'm sure other people listening on here who work on repeaters, they have to realize that also, that figure changes sometimes quite drastically. So you have to take that into account first. What is your online, on-the-air sensitivity coming through your antenna, sensitivity of your repeater receiver? And then you key your transmitter to find out how much worse you make it by keying your transmitter.
Okay, now that's very significant. When you turn on and off the transmitter while measuring receiver sensitivity, while it's connected to the real antenna, 2 dB of desense, you call it desense, it really is 2 dB of limiting somewhere in the receiver. If something is going into 2 dB of limiting, that stage is going into limiting, by definition, is being driven to a nonlinear point where it is a mixer. Therefore, if there's more than one signal present there at that stage simultaneously, you'll get all the N by N, Mike plus November products, you know, the 2x1 and 3x2 and whatever, all possible products of intermodulation distortion will come out. So if this is the best of all worlds, I think you'd rather have almost 0 dB of desensitization when you turn on and off the transmitter. Over to you, Joe, K2IZW.
Very hard to achieve unless you've got, you know, everything is perfect. I'm running RG, I think the cables on the duplex are like RG-142, and in this particular case, I'm also using RG-142 going to the receiver and the transmitter connection point. So that cabling by itself is not as good as, say, quarter-inch superplex is. It's not quite the same feeling. I think that stuff is rated for about 90, 95 dB of isolation. It's not as good as hardline. I wish it was, but it's not. So that's something that sort of comes into the picture also. But I am talking about a on-the-air real sensitivity change in the receiver sensitivity, and I do that by checking the sign edge of the receiver. I know it's 0.25 for 20, and it's a little less than that for 12 dB sign edge, maybe 0.18, 0.19, something like that for 12 dB sign edge by itself. Now, when I put the preamp on there, the preamp may give me a reading of about maybe 0.14, 0.15 for 12 sign edge. Okay? And that's being measured with the preamp in line, past cavity, ahead of the receiver, preamp, and through the duplex. This is being measured first measuring at the antenna input of the duplexer itself, so you go through the whole shebang. First being measured by receiver, the antenna port of the duplexer, so you measure the whole shebang, and then, you turn your transmitter on, and the transmitter, and I'm taking a sign end reading, and the sign end changes just about 2 dB. They've been able to get it really much better than that. You think you should have zero? I don't agree with that. Unless you had a real perfect world, you had absolutely great cabling on your duplexer, no leakage between cans or anything else, I think it's very, very hard to achieve that kind of result where you're going to get, like, no descents. I don't think I've ever heard of that happening. Now, mind you, I'm using a preamp. In a commercial application, using a commercial receiver that might be rated at 0.4, 0.5, 20, or 20 dB of receiver sensitivity, and that type of application, you're not looking further into the noise floor, you may be able to achieve a figure of, close to 0 dB descents between the transfer on, transfer off types of applications. If you add a preamp, everything's got to be that much better to make it work.
For the most part, I agree with all of the above, Joe. Very hard to achieve. So when you do see that 1 or 2 dB of desensitization, when it's all hooked up into the real world, that tells you you better have enough cavities or whatever to make sure that more than one signal is not simultaneously present into that receiver input. Otherwise, you are going to get some in-demand products. Okay. We probably shouldn't keep you too much later. One thing I do notice on each one of your, let me call them 90-second transmissions, the beginning of each transmission, you're nice and strong on both the input and through the machine. At the end of the 90 seconds, your signal is fading downward. I don't hear you on the input anymore, and you're starting to become noisy into the machine. Then you drop for 1 second to reset, and your power comes back up. So it acts like your final stage of the transmitter is going through a heating process there, Joe. So you might want to know about that. W2RYY, K2RYW in the tech man.
This radio is a Maxtrack. It's a 45-watt radio, and I got to say, I think I have it set down set, turned down to about 25, I think it's 40 watt rating, it's turned down about 25 watts. The power doesn't vary. That may just be the action of the TOT starting to shut down the push to torque and other various circuits as it's signaling me. You, I don't know if you can hear it in the background, but it lets out an audible alert in the speaker, even with the microphone depressed. That's how you know that the TOT, you've reached that point. And as soon as I reach that, I let go of the button on the microphone and I reset it instantly. But like I said, I wish the timeout, this thing could be 3 minutes because it would be a whole lot more practical on a TechNet. And I know people have discussed, they've argued that it times at all links, which is actually incorrect because if you find your timeout on the repeater in Glen Oaks, you're still heard on the repeater out in Selden. Likewise, the IRLP and Echo Link, you're still being heard on those also. So it's kind of like a fallacy, you know. It's done for another reason.
Okay, just when I get a chance, I'll have some further discussions with Eric and others and Andy on that exact subject. Okay, thank you for all the information on tuning up a duplexing filter for a repeater. There's a lot of peculiar things going on within those four or six cavities with their notches and impedance matching and insertion losses and Q, loaded Q and unloaded Q and so on. Very complicated machine. A well-tuned duplexer. And my guess is you've seen some duplexers that when they're properly tuned, some of them are very good at holding that tuning for the next year, and some of them in the real environment drift quite a bit. Is that true, Joe? Have you seen drifting duplexers?
Not really. And I'll tell you why. I use all commercial quality duplexers. They're all either Phelps Dodge, Motorola, or, you know, that's pretty much what I use. Or in some case, I use my, I think, Deflaplast when I had a bunch of radio links hooked up. But pretty much primarily right now, I use either a Phelps Dodge duplexer or Motorola duplexer. And they work very well. The PD duplexers have, I think they have a metal inside called INBAR, INBAR. And it's supposed to be to give you a temperature compensation where as the temperature changes, the mechanical structure normally you think would change a lot. Apparently because of this middle metal or compound, whatever it is, called INBAR, it helps reduce the duplexer's changing properties over a moderate temperature range. Nothing's perfect. I mean, if you put something down at, you know, 50 degrees below zero compared to like 220 degrees above, normal temperature or something like that, at 240, 250, I'm sure something would start to drift. But I use good quality commercial duplexes, and once they're set, I leave them alone. I don't touch them. They don't have any reason to adjust them because I can check them periodically when I go up to the repeater site, and I can check the isolation and pretty much know what I set it for like a year or two ago, and I'll get the same similar results again. So that tells me it really hasn't moved very far at all. Back to you.
I just thought about one of the things I read in today's Newsday, page 10, about the spacecraft that's going to Mars, the InSight. The surface of Mars between day and night, and it's about a 25-hour day, between day and night, the surface of Mars shifts 170 degrees Fahrenheit. Can you imagine the alignment procedure required for the duplexing filter that's on the communication equipment, that's on something like the Curiosity spacecraft on the surface of Mars? It has to endure 170 degrees of temperature shift between day and night. I'll bet you aligning that that duplexing filter requires praying for better results. Over to you for any comment on that, Joe. K2RW.
Well, those duplexers, I don't know what frequency bands you're talking about, probably in the microwave region. Those are probably like some of the earlier cellular duplexers I saw in my early years of getting into working in the cellular industry, like 1988. And I was surprised to see this, that they use pretty much bandpass only. They do not use band reject. They use bandpass only, where it's passing, in a case of like B-block cellular, passing 835 or so to 850, 845, and then same thing, 45 megs higher, which is transfer frequency. So they're passing just a block of frequencies. They're not doing a reject. Probably in that type of application, if they do the same thing in up on these microwave space frequencies they're using, they probably have maybe a minimized type of effect with temperatures by using something that's like a block pass of frequencies. Because I don't know how you can keep something at the pass notch type of duplexer operating with that kind of temperature swing. That's asking a hell of a lot for the metal not to do things, you know?
Yeah, the repeater we're all listening to right now has 600 kc of offset between transmit and receive because we want to switch. We want to squeeze a whole lot of individual repeaters into a certain frequency region, 146 to 148 megahertz. In the case of a spacecraft sitting on Mars, you don't have that problem. You can make huge differences between transmit and receive frequency, so you don't have to have nearby notching and whatever. Okay, Joe, thank you for that information. I'm going to go on to the next guy. That was Bob. WB2JOB, go right ahead with your question or comment, Bob. K2LIW in the TechNet, wait for the beep, sir. Bob.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and very interesting comments. I have a question regarding a friend of mine had his son-in-law get involved with amateur radio. This was back in the late 70s, early. At that time, his son-in-law purchased a Kenwood TS-120S. I guess it was maybe 2 years after he received license and got the radio. He became disinterested in amateur radio and dropped out of it and took the radio and stuck it on the shelf. My friend, 2 years ago, took the radio from his son-in-law. It wasn't being used. He figured he would use it as a backup. Wouldn't let it drop. Okay, when he received the radio, he turned it on, and it would receive but not transmit, so he decided to have it repaired as a backup radio, and he took it to a dialer, which probably was. The person supposedly not only repaired the radio, tuned it up the whole 9 yards, I think he charged it with something left on the radio. This was, in any case, a year ago, my friend, many years, became a silent key. His wife asked me to get with him for him, which I've been very successful with, getting the bimodal, the Amatron 811Hs and so forth. But one condition, when I took the radios here to my shack, I wanted to make sure they were working before they were sold, which all of them were. When I plugged in the TS-120, which was the last radio I had to get rid of his wife, went over to 40 meters, it worked fine. Flat 122 SWR, made a contact to it, it went over to 80 meters, so no problem. Now, when I went up to the other bands, 15, 20, 40, and 10 meters, tuned them up, and let me let it drop again. Tuned them up with the SWR meter. Instead of getting modulation, the minute I hit the key, all I got was a steady carrier going out. I don't know what was repaired in the line when he had the radio over to the other person, but I took it apart, changed the switches, thinking there might have been something wrong with the band. I noticed another thing. Went ahead and I turned down the carrier when I went to those bands, and it still put out. The minute I hit the key, it still put out a continuous carrier. Now, it doesn't do that when I go to 40 and 80, which worked perfectly, so just confused as to why 15, 20, and 10 meter puts out a steady carrier with no modulation whatsoever. Back to you, Dick.
I have the answer, WHNCBL, listening.
I was about to suggest that. Go right ahead, Andy.
Yeah, by the way, it wasn't me. It wasn't me who fixed the radio, at least I don't think. I've seen the problem before. It goes into an oscillation, and if you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, you'll see that. If you want, I could take care of the problem. I can't explain on the air what the cause is right now, but that's what it is. It's oscillating on its own on certain bands, and that could be corrected. But back to you, Dick.
Any possibility, Andy, it's a feedback into the mic circuit because there's not enough shielding on the microphone circuit, and any feedback can give you all kinds of oscillations. In fact, a feedback oscillation has a very characteristic waveform that you might recognize on a spectrum analyzer. Back to you, Andy.
No, it's usually occurring in the final amplifier stage itself. And it could be a function of the way it's tuned or the way it was tuned in the past. So that's nothing to do with the modulation circuits at all. It's all RF.
Would proper tuning of the neutralization circuitry of the final stage help any?
This is just to clarify, the TS-120 he's talking about?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah, that's a solid state radio, by the way. Fully solid state, broadband amp. Broadband's a final amp, so it's all in the amplifier.
With a number as low as 120, I assumed it was an older tube rig. Wow. So they jumped down to the number 120. I mean, a 520, for instance, has a 6146s in the final. So Kenwood made a 120 after the 520, an all solid state. Amazing. Over to you, Andy.
Yes, it's all solid state. Yeah, and it's a small compact radio. It's a nice radio. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles, but it's nice, and it's a small packet. All right, if the gentleman wants to get a hold of me, just, if you don't mind, I'll give him my email address if he wants to email me.
Why don't you give that to him right now, Andy?
It's my call, WA2, Commercial Driver's License, CDL, at Verizon.net, N-E-T. All right, if you got that, send me an email, and I'll respond. And then we'll go from there. WA2CDL, Verizon.net, okay? That will help.
When it comes to those Kenwood rigs, by now you've seen quite a few of those for repair, haven't you, Andy? Like more than 10 of them? All Kenwood rigs altogether?
Well, I have about maybe 280 service manuals or so, so that's at least how many rigs I've seen.
Wow. Okay. Hey, Bob, I think you know where to go with that rig if you want that problem to go away. WB2JOB, K2RIW, you got it, Bob. My name is Dick.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, Andy, it definitely wasn't you. It was another gentleman that I'm sure all of you in my mind know who I'm referring to, or the company that owns. No, it wasn't you. Yes, I do have your email address, Andy. I am going to send you an email. Of course, we'll have mine on and all of that, and we'll talk about directions, and I can go over there. Yeah, I don't want to get rid of any of his equipment unless it's absolutely working condition or have to sell it as a technician special, which I really don't want to do with. I'd really like to see it go out the door and work. So definitely, Andy, I will be sending you an email, probably tomorrow, and we can go from there as far as cost and whatnot. And as I say, he already paid $250 for the other individual, and I don't know what the other individual did, not through the radio, but I know it was working when he had it on. Whether he used it on any of the other bands, unbeknownst to me, and of course, it's a silent key, so I can't. In any case, thanks a lot for that information, Andy. It sounds good, and I will be in touch with you. So back to you, Dick. KDURIWWB2JOB.
And Bob, when it comes to transporting the equipment over to Andy's house, he's in Hempstead, you're in Bronx. That's not a super long drive. So, if you choose the right day when Andy's home during the week, or even on a weekend. So, after you guys finish talking to each other, getting together is going to be pretty easy. You'll be quite happy when you see the amount of test equipment that Andy has in his shop. He's got two shops, one in the basement and one in the garage. He probably has some other test equipment in a few other rooms in the house if I know Andy. Okay. One last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the question and answer section of the TechNet?
Repeater, timeout.
Anyone else who wants to sign in or didn't get a chance to sign in earlier, give me a call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's WB2JO. Yeah, no problem with him. So they go out to the airport and going out to 54. So it's not a problem to get that thing whatsoever. Quite a number of times. All right, thanks a lot, Andy, and I will be in touch. And Dick, thank you for putting me in touch with Andy there. Glad you jumped in and kind of resolved my problem. I know what to do now, and that is nothing until I get to meet you. So anyhow, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it. So far, right, WB2. Thank you, Dick.
I have a message to Eric, WHCDL.
Go right ahead with your message.
Okay, sorry to interrupt again. I just received a phone call So Eric, that EchoLink is down. There's someone trying to get into the TechNet through EchoLink, but it's not working. So he wanted me to pass the message on to Eric.
I'll check it out.
The connection out to the east eastern machine, that's working well, but I don't have a way of checking EchoLink. Alrighty, we're going to the next section of the TechNet, which is Dr. Roy, AC2GS, with his science talk. And he's got a bunch of pretty good subjects here tonight. One of them is a strange one, about failures that happen of equipment that's near a MRI machine. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Just tell me how my signal is right now. It looks nice on my scope, but how does it sound?
The best you've ever sound. High fidelity.
Okay, very good. By the way, I'm running EchoLink. It seems to be working here. It might be a problem joining the group, but once you're on the group, in the group, it seems to be working, and it's sending an audio signal. So to start off the ScienceNet, as always, there's a couple of things I like to tell people. If you have a topic or a question or want to comment or refute whatever I say, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to read further about any of the things that I discuss, I put links on a webpage, and the webpage is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, it's a web, you put it on the browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll get to the web link. Now, don't send me email on the web page, because there's another guy who's the webmaster of that page, and he gets my mail. So please, if you need to talk to me, if you need to contact me, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I maintain a little chat room, and the easiest way to get there is to just type in your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and it will bring you right to the chat room. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, the first thing I wanted to try out tonight is a little troubleshooting question. I've been kind of asking people around, and I think it's a nice little thing to kind of exercise your neurons. Recently, there was a technician in a laboratory that was asked to explain why over 20 iPhones as old as the iPhone 6 and including the newer models appear to be dying in the lab. The one good clue that he had was that an MRI was purchased recently, a few weeks earlier, and placed in operation just before the iPhones crashed. That was about all this guy had to go on at first, so I thought I would throw it out to the audience. And keep in mind, I'm not going to ask you anything obvious, so the answer is not going to be a horse, if you will. It's not going to be very esoteric, so it's not going to be a unicorn. It'll be something around a zebra. So does anyone out there have any kind of gut feeling of why a newfangled cell phone should start to crash when it's taken in and out of an MRI room?
K-E-2-E-J.
Is Eric, you want to make a comment, Eric?
My comment is the EchoLink is not broken. The operators are broken. They don't leave enough time for the system to get active enough to be able to get in. Although the folks out there listening on EchoLink, let me tell you that if you type the word break, B-R-E-A-K, in the text window, you'll hear your call announced, or at least the other folks will hear your call announced, which might give you an opportunity. But I just wanted to get that in there. Back to you, Dick, and then give it back.
Thank you, Eric. And quite a bit of feedback in the background, which you probably already know about. These little mechanical reed-like circuits that are in a number of our iPhones these days, I suspect that they cannot tolerate the very strong magnetic field. The particular watch I'm wearing, I'm very happy with this particular watch. Trying to find out what brand name it is, I've forgotten.
Yep.
The watch, what's nice about it, it's not a very expensive watch, I like the styling of it, but it gains 1 second per month. I've never had a watch that with that kind of accuracy. If I was going to get an MRI test, I would make sure I do not bring that watch of mine into the room with me, because I'm a little bit afraid something would change. The modern-day, very high-resolution, three Tesla MRI machines, that strong a magnetic field can do some strange things. You want to assure me, sure that there is no oxygen bottle or CO2 bottle anywhere near in that same room, because if that ever gets sucked into that machine, boy, can that be one heck of a missile. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW. Give a long break in case somebody wants to break in.
Well, Dick, you're certainly right that magnetic fields can destroy all kinds of electronic equipment, and usually any sane MRI technician will not allow people to carry their cell phones anywhere close to the MRI when it's being turned on. There's signs all over the place to keep any kind of ferrous material as far away as humanly possible, because as you mentioned, the MRIs utilize very strong magnetic fields, and you turn those things on and things start to fly across the room can be extraordinarily dangerous. So let's assume that no one actually turned the MRI on while the people were in the room with their cell phone.
The machine being turned on or turned off, in my opinion, makes no difference. When you charge up a machine, an MRI machine, with the liquid helium, and you set the magnetic field, you leave that magnetic field on 24/7. You don't just turn the magnetic field on and off. That's running all the time, even if the machine is not running. That's my first guess on that one, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, but there's a shielded facility where people can carry cell phones, and there's an unshielded facility where it's verboten and such. And this is going on in an area within the general place that the MRIs are in, where the magnetic field is not a problem for the point of this particular problem. It had nothing to do with any magnetic field.
And this failure mode you're describing, was it a certain percentage of the pieces of electronics people own that failed, or if they were there long enough, they all failed? How serious was the problem, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, according to the story, they didn't really give a statistical analysis. It was more anecdotal that over 20 people with relatively newer models of iPhones had significant failures of their machines. Android phones tended to not have be a problem, and older iPhones as well didn't have a problem. But they listed at least the 20 iPhones as Model 6 and above that were just spontaneously just seeming to fail out of nowhere.
GXM?
Yes, GXM.
B2GXM, Rich. Could it be a redesigned antenna inside the newer iPhones causing the problem?
Well, that's an interesting suggestion. How would you suggest that the antenna would cause a failure for a MRI? Again, maybe magnetic pulse doing something, but it's not a magnetic pulse.
I'm kind of reaching here. I have seen on videos where an iPhone was intentionally brought near an electromagnetic source, and it scrambled the phone pretty well. So I would imagine a more sensitive antenna would pick up electromagnetic fields better than older phones and therefore aggravate the problem, WB2GXM.
Okay, I agree with you, Rich, and if people brought me that problem, that would be my go-to suggestion, and that to me is the horse. You know, when I was talking about there are horses, there are zebras, and there are unicorns. The answer to this one, fortunately or unfortunately, is not a horse, it's more of a zebra. So it has actually nothing to do with the electromagnetic emanations of the MRI machine.
Because it's in a shielded room and it has to go to maximum power all the time.
Okay, you cut out the early portion of what you were saying.
Yeah, KC1SAM. Because it's in a shielded room and it has to go to maximum power all the time. And that'll run the battery down.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the WQVL.
Did I go through?
Yeah, you went through, Sam, but I'm a little confused. Are you alluding to the MRI machine or are you alluding to the cell phone machine?
When the cell phone doesn't have contact with a tower, it increases power output, so it can make contact with that tower. Being in a shielded room, it probably didn't have any contact, or very, very, very weak contact, so it was running at high capacity all the time, and that would run the battery down.
Okay, that's an interesting one. The problem, though, was that if they put it on a charger, it still wouldn't work.
But what is the failure? Did I miss something? KC2SHO. I didn't hear what the failure was.
That's the puzzle. The puzzle is to figure out what's failing and why. I thought people might enjoy the puzzle involved in it. If I give you the answer, then we can discuss the details, but I thought it would be more fun to kind of present it initially without telling you exactly what's failing and...
Actually, I'm kind of curious. Dick made a comment about CO2 and oxygen in the MRI room. How does the magnetism affect those gases, WB2GX up?
Well, as far as I'm aware, there's no real tanks of CO2 in an MRI machine. Oxygen might be necessary for the patients, but that's about the only type of a gas that I could perceive anyone of using. The gases aren't really terribly affected by magnetic fields. Mostly they're diamagnetic and very weakly diamagnetic. So oxygen, though, is slightly magnetic, and you can do a little trick. If you ever have liquid oxygen, you can stick a magnet in it, and globs of liquid oxygen will stick to the magnet. But gaseous form, there's not really that much to be worried about.
E2FIU.
Yes, George.
Hey, Roy, good to hear you. I think the question here is what is the user's lack of service? We're not asking root cause, you're asking us root cause. What is the lack of service that the user has? Is the phone portion in UHF digital band going down? Is it the data band going down? Is it the phone going blank until they walk out of the area? What is the user's experience that is occurring with the phone?
The phone just suddenly goes blank, and you take it out of the room, across the street, down the road, and it's still blank and unresponsive.
The phone ever recover?
Okay, this might be a clue for answering it. Yes, it does, after a long time.
The scrambling of the microprocessors, bus speed.
Fortunately, two people were doubling, George and someone else, and someone mentioned bus speed.
That was me, KD2FIU. It could be a scrambling of the microprocessor bus speed.
Okay, but if it was a scrambling of the microprocessor's bus speed, why would it continue to be a problem down the road?
Don't know. The phone may have auto reset features after a specific period of time.
Okay, well, I'll give you another little clue that it's not an inherent reset feature of the machinery. of the cell phone. Who is the other person who also